Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Hi, this is Mark Graben from the Lean Blog. This is episode number 20 of the podcast for March 18th, 2007. Our guest today is Kevin Meyer from the Evolving Excellence blog, and we're going to be talking about a number of his blog posts and case studies. So if you haven't done so before, I invite you to check out the post on my blog for this episode of the podcast to see links to those different topics that we're talking about. The easiest way to visit that would be to go to www.leanpodcast.org, or you can visit the regular blog site at leanblog.org. Well, our guest today is Kevin Meyer from Superfactory and the Evolving Excellence blog. Thanks for being here, Kevin.
Thank you.
It's a question I like to ask a lot of our guests, and I thought we'd start off with a question about how you got started with Lean and kind of what drew you into the field.
I probably got started thinking about it back in the mid-1990s. I was with Abbott Laboratories at the time. We were building a new facility, and we were trying to figure out how to lay it out and looking around for the best ways of processing material without having to do a lot of inspection, a lot of value, or additional operations. And we came across Lean and Womack's first book, and we were going through some of that and took it from there. Tried to lay out the new building to allow for straight process flows and then some cells in some areas, and really just could not find a lot of online resources, and that's where the Superfactory website started. I just came across some resources that I put out as a simple internal list for some of my group, and some of the other plants wanted access. And before I knew it, some people outside the company wanted access, so I spent about 10 seconds coming up with the admittedly a little bit cheesy name, and it's grown from there. So
yeah. So when did you get started with the website?
That was back in 97, 98,
okay.
When that first took hold. And as the internet grew, the website grew, and it's, you know, over the last few years, it has really taken off with a lot of articles and reviews and just general resources on Lean.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of listeners may know you from the blog that you started as part of your site.
Yeah, I think we probably started both of our blogs at about the same time, in late 2004, early 2005, somewhere along those lines. And for me, it was just an experiment and some new communication method. I was just exploring it, and it was amazing how many people started reading it. And over time, we found what kind of articles people like to hear, and the feedback, I think, is what really makes it exciting. And I know you and I have talked that one of the unique things with several of the Lean blogs, ours and John Miller's, Gimma Pantere, and all, is we all seem to feed on each other. It's not like some of the political ones where there's a lot of competition between the blogs.
There's not a lot of sniping back and forth. I agree. I've enjoyed that it's a pretty cooperative, friendly community of blogs, which I think is a nice thing.
So, you know, there have been, you know, some hot buttons we've each hit on that. But I think I look at it as just a way of expanding the box that people think in. And, you know, sometimes we wonder, you know, whether we need to be 100% accurate or really research the articles. But in my mind, it's, you know, getting ideas out there for people to think about. And I think we often hit some hot buttons on that, and we have forced some people to think about some ideas.
Yeah, and I guess when you write a book, you only get, you know, one chance to do it right the first time, so there's a little different burden, I guess. You know, you're doing a blog, and I know this is the case on mine. You know, the nice thing, even though I try to do it right the first time, if you're wrong, somebody will tell you, and I learn a lot in the process from that.
There's very, very quick feedback on what people think, which I actually find very exciting, seeing how other people think and how other people react. And, you know, being corrected on something helps me learn. The blog and website for that matter has been a huge learning experience for me, and that's what I get out of it, what I learn and the people I meet. I don't know how I'd meet people, like Jim Womack and, Bodek and some of them otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I definitely have links to your blog over at my site. For those of you listening, it's www.evolvingexcellence.com. Right, Kevin?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Certainly encourage everyone to go check that out if you haven't already. Now, the main reason we got together today was to talk about a topic that Kevin is going to be moderating a session on at my alma mater from undergrad at Northwestern University. He's going to be at the Kellogg School of Management talking about a term and a topic called insourcing. So I was hoping, Kevin, you could kind of introduce us to that topic and why it's important and how it relates to Lean.
Well, this is something that has become sort of a hot button for me, or a very high interest level for me, is companies that have been able to create a competitive competency by operating from U.S.-based factories. There's a lot of companies that believe you have to go overseas and chase low labor rates in order to be competitive. And we've quite honestly blasted several of them in the blog for doing that. In the Lean world, those of us that have dealt a lot with Lean, you look at the total cost of procurement or cost of manufacturing, and you start to realize that having boatloads of product on the high seas for a couple of months introduces a lot of cost to the system, and it's definitely not value from the customer's perspective. So what we have found are several companies that can operate and have found ways to operate very effectively from U.S.-based factories. They focus on their own internal waste as opposed to just strictly labor cost, and have found that by reducing their internal waste, they can more than offset that labor cost, and they save the knowledge that those employees have and shorten the supply chain, quicker cycle times to their customers. There's a lot of value there from the perspective of the customer. This particular conference, again, it's something that came to me as a result of the blogging, is put on by Kellogg, and they have an annual manufacturing business conference that the MBA students put on, and this year it'll be May 12th, and it is open to everyone. You can go to the link on the website to sign up, and they have actually added a panel discussion on domestic manufacturing as a competitive advantage. Several of the companies that will be on that panel are ones that we've talked about on the blog. Harley-Davidson, for one, Sherrill Manufacturing as another, and there are a few more that we're waiting to hear from. And you know, they operate globally and very competitively from U.S.-based factories.
Yeah. Other than trying to get the word out about Lean or through conferences like this, I mean, you mentioned the the common perception that you have to go overseas nowadays for manufacturing. A lot of that is not just in the manufacturing companies, but it's driven in the mainstream media. I mean, a lot of articles are written almost from the standpoint of, if they find somebody still building something in the U.S., there's like, this shock and amusement of, oh, how quaint, we're still building stuff here. I mean, is there anything we can do to try to influence that perspective? Is that something we're just going to have to deal with until there's a, kind of a major reawakening that manufacturing can be beneficial here?
Well, I think conferences like this and panel discussions like this will help that. You're absolutely right. I've come across some furniture manufacturers that could not raise capital because their investors believed they had to go overseas to be competitive, even though they had proven via some lean methods that they could operate effectively from the U.S. And that's really, it's driving some major decisions in that lines. And the perception goes all the way down to some small companies. We know of a couple of custom ski manufacturers that produce all of maybe one container load of skis a year, but are setting up plants and relationships in China to build those skis for just a tiny volume, and the labor cost on some of it is not all that high. So you're right, the perception does need to be changed. I'm hoping that panel discussions like this will start to change it in the mainstream media. There are some organizations that are large, Danaher being one, mm-hmm. that does operate very effectively from the U.S. Harley-Davidson is very high profile as well. So the more that we can point out those successes, the better.
Yeah, and I know on your blog you've got a list of kind of, you know, the good list of the companies that have got good case studies at least. I'll make sure I link back to that on my website on the posting about this podcast so people can go back. There are a lot of encouraging examples. I mean, you mentioned mm-hmm. furniture. There's a company sort of in my backyard here in the Dallas area called American Leather that is building furniture here in Texas, you know, with Texas labor rates and, you know, their competitive advantages, you know, the fast response time that they can do. You know, they're sort of like the Dell computer of furniture in a way, you know, how they portray themselves, that, you know, we can do custom and we can do it at a, you know, a surprisingly affordable rate because of lean processes within their factories.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great example.
Now, have you seen any examples of companies that have maybe previously made an attempt at going overseas to China or even down to Mexico, which is a common low labor cost company or country, people coming back and sort of repatriating production, if you will, back to the U.S.?
There are a few. A couple of years ago, I came across a couple of plants of Jostens that were moving back. There are some suppliers of Home Depot that are doing the same thing. Home Depot, you would think that that'd be very high volume, that'd be made overseas, but Home Depot's trying to shorten their supply chains and do shorter cycle times on some of their changes. And to be able to accomplish that, some of their suppliers are having to move back to the U.S. Just today I wrote about Avery Dennison, and they're consolidating a distribution center and a couple of manufacturing plants and increasing the size of their plant in Marion, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And that could actually entail the closing of a Mexican plant to accomplish that. So I think when companies look at their total cost and the amount of cash they have tied up in supply chains and total risk mm-hmm. cash tied up in product that, you know, especially if it has an expiration or is beholden to, you know, changes in what the customer wants, there's a true value in short cycle times.
Absolutely. And it seems like so far, I mean, we both of us like to criticize, you know, companies or executives who make, you know, some of these decisions, but it seems like we've identified three maybe systemic causes already of either, you know, media perception, mm-hmm. You know, the financial community and retailers. Have you seen other, I know you've written about other examples of retailers either helping encourage lean practices or at the other extreme forcing manufacturers overseas, correct?
Well, there are retailers that want to receive their product in large container loads into large distribution channels, you know, Walmart being one very big one. And to accomplish that with very thin margins, you're almost forced to go overseas. But I think as, you know, maybe customers start to demand more and more unique products built exactly how they want them and have changing desires, that may force the need for shorter cycle times.
It sort of strikes me, you know, Walmart has talked a lot about, you know, environmental stewardship and, you know, pushing things like, you know, compact fluorescent bulbs and things that they say are good for the environment. But, you know, mm-hmm. pushing suppliers overseas and either the pollution that's caused with the Chinese manufacturing or all of the fuel and the transportation waste of bringing products over from an environmental context doesn't necessarily seem to fit in as the greenest approach.
That's very true. I mean, we hear about some of the human rights issues going on in China and the pollution issues. And I think one that I'm also very concerned about for companies that have just blindly gone over there is the rapid increase in the wage rates in China. That's going to demolish the very fundamental financial rationale for going over there in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, in my mind, there's really only a couple of valid reasons for going offshore, and probably the predominant being to get closer to a customer. If you're going to try to go after the Chinese market itself, obviously it makes sense to build a plant in China if there are significant shipping costs and so on involved. But otherwise, you know, close to your customer. Toyota is very successful in the U.S. They don't feel a need to complain about competitiveness burdens. So, you know, the one example I like to point out is American Apparel in Los Angeles, where they have 4,000 workers earning above minimum wage, making just very basic T-shirts, and they pay excellent benefits. Their employees like to work there, and they have higher margins than product coming from Asian sweatshops. So if they can do it, you would think almost anyone could.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it seems like stories like that don't really get out as much as they could to help people see there is a different way than going offshore. And in fact, earlier I think I used the wrong phrase. I think I said insourcing. The topic for the conference really is onshoring as opposed to offshoring. Correct.
Right. They're related. Insourcing would be moving your factory back to the U.S. Onshoring, they're staying in the U.S. to begin with, or staying domestic. I think there are probably similar situations in all countries. I just written about where in New Zealand, some people are proposing that New Zealand manufacturing companies should move their factories offshore to actually augment New Zealand manufacturing, which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But there are a lot of countries that are dealing with this very same issue of seeing their manufacturing base go elsewhere.
Yeah, because even, I mean, China's still a relatively long boat trip from New Zealand, you know, not as far as the U.S., but.
I think another major issue that a lot of companies don't think about when they're doing this is just the value of the knowledge of their employees. That's not tracked on any balance sheet, but you know, Whirlpool is laying off thousands of people to move operations to Mexico, and what is the value of 2,000 people at I think it was an average of 21 years of experience compared to the 2,000 people they're hiring at a new plant that are brand new off the street. From a lean perspective, you're looking to your people to give you ideas on how to improve your operations and improve your productivity. People with 21 years of experience would probably have a lot better ideas on where to look for improvements.
And somehow that's not really valued or respected. I mean, it seems like there's too much of a perception if you haven't really worked in a factory and haven't worked side by side with, you know, production operators and the value-added employees that. And I say this as an MBA graduate myself of a different school, that maybe there's a certain MBA arrogance of, you know, well, I have a master's degree and you barely got through high school. What could you possibly know about making anything better, right?
Right, right. If you don't actually visit the factory floor, and probably if you don't visit other functions within the company for that matter, you're looking at it just purely based on the wage rate or cost of that operation. And then it becomes, in your mind, a very simple financial decision of $19 an hour versus $4 an hour or something like that. And it's not that simple. There's a lot of intangibles that, unfortunately, are not reflected on a balance sheet or a P&L that help drive manufacturing.
Yeah. So it's a no-brainer only if you're looking at it in a very simple-brained type view, maybe.
Right. And that becomes difficult to change, especially in a public company when you're beholden to investors that often have a very short time horizon. They're looking for a quick return, and driving down base labor costs is a very easy way of driving a quick return. Unfortunately, it's not a good way of driving long-term success.
Right. Well, good. I was wondering I'll make sure that there are links on the website if listeners want to go to leanpodcast.org. But if you could remind us again in closing the name of the conference that you're speaking at, and then also tell our listeners about the book that you've had released off of the blog.
Okay. The conference is actually sponsored by the Kellogg School at Northwestern. And it's called the Manufacturing Business Conference. It's on May 12th. You can learn more about that. There's a link on my blog at evolvingexcellence.com and also at the Kellogg School at Northwestern.
Okay.
And then you're right. We had my co-blogger, Bill Waddell, and I had taken several of our best posts and at the suggestion of some of our readers and turned them into a book that we just published a couple months ago. And one advantage of the book is it's just a very easy read. They're short stories, basically. You can read one or two a night. So it's a perspective.
Yeah. Well, and I'm holding a copy of it here. I think you're selling it short. When you say a few stories, it's 400 some pages. It's a quite a collection of short stories and good blog posts. So.
Yep, I think you'll find the same thing when you look back on how much you write when you're blogging. It's rather astounding. 458 pages was probably cutting out 2/3 of what we'd written. So blogging is an interesting endeavor.
Yep, and it's the easiest format at least these days for reading the blog on an airplane. So that's one other good benefit of that. So. I'm glad that's out there and wish you luck with the book and with the conference and, of course, continued success with the website and the blog. I certainly, you know, it's part of my daily blog reading and, you know, hope others will continue to make it so.
Well, yours is definitely part of my daily reading as well.
Well, it's been great having you here on the podcast. I appreciate you taking time out today, Kevin.
It's been interesting to explore this new medium as well.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.